You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
A film historian, Scott Eyman, returns to the show. He has written excellent biographies of filmmakers, film stars, and histories of the Golden Age of Hollywood. His books include Print the Legend, The Life and Times of John Ford, Lion of Hollywood, The Life and Legend of Louis B. Mayer, John Wayne, The Life and Legend, and Hank and Jim, The 50-Year Friendship of Henry Fonda and James Stewart. His new book is Cary Grant, A Brilliant Disguise. Scott Eyman, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Happy to be here, Gary. How you doing?
Good, thank you. The title of your book, Cary Grant, A Brilliant Disguise, and the story you tell, leads us to believe that the man that we saw on screen and the man who played him were very different. Would you say that that's more than the case with John Wayne or Henry Fonda or Jimmy Stewart?
Well, I think most movie stars of that generation tended to play emphasized aspects of their own characters. It made it easier, you know. I mean, Clark Gable, you know, liked to go motorcycle riding and hunting birds, you know, so that you can see that kind of element in his screen persona. Fonda was kind of touchy and proud and a bit of a hair trigger temper on screen. And, you know, there were aspects of that off screen as well for him. But Archie Leach and Cary Grant were far more diametrically opposed than most of the characters of his peer group, of Cary Grant's peer group, because Cary Grant was an evolutionary process. You know, he did. If you look at his early movies at Paramount when he got there in 1930, end of 1931, started working in 1932. He's awkward. He doesn't really know what to do with his hands. He doesn't project anything at all. He's actually kind of an 8x10 glossy on the screen. He just seems frozen in place. And it took him 5, 6, 7 years really to assemble all the disparate pieces that became Cary Grant, that we associate with Cary Grant. But the Cary Grant, the audiences saw in 1932 and 33 was a long, long way from the Cary Grant of 1939 and 1940.
The Topper is the film, I think, where you've pointed out that you first see him the way we know him.
Yes. Topper's early. Topper's 1937. But if it had come out 1940 or 41, it would have been right in keeping with the Cary Grant that audiences were already familiar with by that time. That's really the one where he begins to assemble all the pieces that he's been working on for the last 5, 6 years.
You know, let's just get to this right away.
The overall point is that he was a studied actor, a studied movie star, as opposed to a natural movie star.
Yeah, so you think the others that we were just mentioning that you've written about are more natural? It came more naturally to them?
I think, well, Fonda was a compulsive actor. Fonda, you know, wanted to be an actor from the time he was, you know, a teenager, really. So that was his object of contemplation. Gable, I think, got into it through the back door. Grant got into it, I suspect, because as with a lot of other people in the world, he was in running away from his childhood, which was miserable by any stretch of the imagination, any way you care to look at it, and figured that if he got leverage, if he got money, if he got position, then he could put all that behind him. And of course, once you get all those things, you find it, what's the character in the movie says, no matter where you go, there you are. You know, there's no real escaping from your past.
Yeah. And you say he really found family by coming to show business.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, that was what drew to him. And he was very open about that because he was a street kid, essentially, and very much of a lone wolf as a young man, even when he was 13, 14 years old. But he was a compulsive theater goer. He was in love with movies and he was in love with the music hall, vaudeville. And he would go to the two vaudeville houses in Bristol, his hometown, and see all these acts. And he got a job in one of the theaters. And hanging around backstage, and he saw the camaraderie the performers had, that easy back and forth, an almost familial sense of What time's the show? What do you want to do after the show? Are we going on drinking? Are we going to bed? You know, that kind of thing. We're just, it was an extended family. And he was terribly attracted by that because it was a sort of, there were bonds there that he'd never experienced as a young boy in Bristol. And I think that's what drew it to him. It was a surrogate family. He was looking for a surrogate family.
And I guess, you know, I think of all of the contemporaries that we've been discussing, Cary Grant is the most natural with comedy. They all did comedy. All of those actors did comedy. And some of them, like Jimmy Stewart, did it quite well. But Cary Grant is hilariously funny. He's so funny. He's so
physical. He's a brilliant comedian. He's a brilliant verbal comedian. He's a brilliant physical comedian. And, of course, he's got that face. I mean, looks like Cary Grants were always going to be an entree into show business. For anybody that looks like that is going to get offers to go into show business, go into acting, theater, the movies, whatever. But a lot of people, there's nothing beyond their appearance. You know, a lot of actors whose careers have considerable careers or whose careers peter out in the beginning stages, it's because they have nothing to offer other than their looks. But Grant had, beneath his looks, he had remarkable performance skills.
Do you think he was as adept as a dramatic actor?
Yes, when he was fully engaged and when he wasn't scared. The performance he gives for Hitchcock in Notorious is a superb performance. And it's not an easy part because the character is suffused with rage and anger and hostility. And it's all directed at his ostensible love object, the Ingrid Bergman character, which is a difficult feat to pull off. On the one hand, you want her. On the other hand, you want to kill her, you know?
Yeah.
And of course, his other fine dramatic performance is None But the Lonely Heart, which is the only time he ever really played someone like Archie Leach. And he was very open about that as well, that he let the audience in. The audience wasn't particularly interested, so he went back to being Cary Grant because they weren't interested in Archie Leach, which I suspect he'd always suspected anyway. You know, that's why he went to so much trouble to come up with an alternative personality.
He never won an Oscar of all these people.
He got an honorary Oscar.
Yeah,
he was nominated for Penny Serenade, and he was nominated for None But the Lonely Heart, both fairly serious pictures.
Do you think he cared that he didn't get one?
Yeah. Oh, sure. I think recognition was part and parcel of the status and the leverage that he desired. I think it would have meant a lot to him.
Yeah, I'm sure it would. I mean, I remember when he got his special one, and he was very touched. And there was a marvelous clip fest right before he got it that really showed the range of what a great actor he was. He'd already been retired from the screen for quite a few years by then.
He retired in 66. The Oscar, I think, was awarded in 70 or 71.
Why did he retire at such a young age? I mean, comparatively. I mean, he still lived another 20-some years, right?
That's a complicated question. There are several components to it. On the one hand, he had all the money he ever dreamt of and more. He was extremely wealthy by this time. Then there was his daughter, who was born in 1966, the same year he retired. It was no accident. He had always adored children. He always wanted children. He'd never had children with his previous three wives. The marriage to Diane Cannon, who was the mother of Jennifer, his child, was very short duration because it was he married another actress. You know, well, it's very difficult for any. It's for two actors to live together under the same roof. I mean, there's Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward, and there's John Cassavetes and Jenna Rollins, and there might be one or two others, but there's not a lot of primary examples. You know, it's just not a good idea. There's not enough oxygen in the house to supply two performers. So the marriage blew up, but there was Jennifer, and that was his supreme object of adoration, supreme object of contemplation. And I think he was bored with the Cary Grant business. I'm convinced he was bored with the Cary Grant business. He made a picture called That Touch of Mink with Doris Day in 1962. He produced it himself, and it's not a good picture. And he walks through it, and everybody that worked on the picture could tell he was completely disengaged. You know, it's not that he was hostile. He was pleasant. He was affable. He simply wasn't available, you know. Doris Day wanted to be friends. He's not really interested. The director couldn't get through to him. He was just walking through it, collecting his paycheck. And when an actor gets to that stage, you know, where they're not feeling it anymore, The problem is most actors don't have any alternative. That's why most actors keep acting until the coffin lid is screwed down. You know, they just won't stop. When they can't stand up, they'll act sitting down. And when they can't sit up, they'll act lying down. You know, they just won't retire. Sean Connery, who left us yesterday, was an example of a guy who walked away. Gene Hackman walked away. Occasionally, an actor will walk away, but they're rare. They're the exceptions. Grant also walked away. And also, there's another thing. There's another a component. He was a very intelligent man. He wasn't well-educated, but he was extremely intelligent, and he had excellent instincts. And I think he understood that the genre that he'd made his own was coming to an end. You know, the romantic comedy genre, that it was because the masters of that genre, the master directors that he'd worked with, whether it was Leo McCarey or Howard Hawks, or in a slightly different aspect of it, Alfred Hitchcock, were getting old. And Hawks had gone into the John Wayne business full time because he didn't know how to survive otherwise. McCarey was dying. Hitchcock was in clear decline. So where do you go? So he made Charade with Stanley Donen. He made a couple of good pictures with Stanley Donen. But I just think he was bored with getting up at 5:30 in the morning to get to the studio and drinking coffee out of plastic cups. And it wasn't fun anymore. And also, I think he was vain. He was worried about his looks. He didn't want to play opposite 30 and 35-year-old actresses. He felt it only emphasized his own age in a negative way. Although he looked good, he looked middle-aged for 15 years, basically. He looked 50 for 15 years. But I think he felt ultimately that he wanted a life that was more authentic, and he didn't think he could have an authentic life as long as he continued being an actor. So he just simply retired and raised his daughter and served on boards, to cover his overhead and enjoyed his life. And in the process, he became much more like the screen Cary Grant than he ever had been when he was working as a Cary Grant. Because he was more relaxed, and he didn't have to worry about, being an imposter. Feeling like an imposter, worried about being discovered as an imposter.
You know, I think today people could care less about the sexuality of their movie stars. But there was obviously, Cary Grant lived in a time when that wasn't the case. And many actors, Rock Hudson, Tab Hunter, whatever, lived closeted lives. Mm-hmm. There's still this, I think there's a deeper interest in Cary Grant's sexuality than any other. And I think that's because there have been books written about it. But did you uncover any mysteries? What do you think? What is the verdict on Cary Grant's sexuality?
I don't honestly think he was gay. That said, I think depending on what team you're rooting for, think you could make some kind of case for him as gay or as straight or as bisexual. But as I say in the book, people have to remember that neither Archie Leach or Cary Grant ever played for any team but their own. He was a lone wolf, and he made his own decisions, and he had several long-term friendships with, and lived for a time with, Ori Kelly, a great costume designer, off and on for 4 years, maybe more. Randolph Scott, he lived with for 8 years. Everybody I talked to, I talked to several friends of his, who never saw any evidence of anything, involving homosexuality. But, another friend of his, basically he said that, that you should try all aspects of your personality. To be otherwise would be like playing one part all your life, which is funny coming from Cary Grant, who tended to just play one part for most of his life. But I understand exactly what he was talking about. And I think that's probably the most reliable estimate of where he was coming from.
Yeah. Do you think, a lot of that speculation is happening during his lifetime, did he ever comment on it? Or
He said he was grateful because it a lot of women tried to prove the rumors wrong, and he allowed them to.
That's funny.
He said he didn't mind. I think he probably didn't mind. No one wants to have that kind of the backstage whispers going on around them. because he had rabbit ears anyway. You know, he was very attuned to the embarrassment and humiliation because of his childhood. And so it couldn't have pleased him at all. I don't think he enjoyed the whispers or the sotto voce notoriety.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro, and my guest this week is Scott Iman. He's a film historian, and he's written biographies of John Ford and John Wayne, Henry Fonda, and Jimmy Stewart, and his new book is called Cary Grant, A Brilliant Disguise.
Cary Grant worked with some of the most astounding directors. I mean, a lot of these actors that we've talked about have worked with great directors, but how many of them worked with Hitchcock, Capra, Hawks, George Stevens, George Cukor, Leo McGarry? That's an astounding array of them.
And all of their best work, too. Some of their best work was with Cary Grant. There's a reason for that. Because Cary Grant compared acting to playing catch. And he said a lot of actors not only don't throw the ball back, they don't catch the ball. Because basically they're dead behind the eyes because they're waiting for their cue. You know, they're thinking about the next line. They're not really listening to the other actor. They're not really engaged in the moment. Which is a bit of actor studio verbiage that Grant, I'm sure, would have no patience with, whatever. But he understood that you have to have a sense of play if you're going to be an actor. You have to have a sense of abandon if you're going to be a good actor. You know, you have to go with what the other actor's doing, and which can enlarge you or compress you, depending upon the scene and depending upon the actor. He liked actors. Actually, he was much more attuned to leading ladies, I think, than he was to other male actors. When he would talk about actors he liked to work with, he would mention Irene Dunne or Ingrid Bergman or Grace Kelly. Those were his three. That was his troika of great, great actresses that he loved. He rarely spoke about other actors, you know. He would talk about, you know, Victor Laughlin being this big huggable bear of a man, and Doug Fairbanks. And he went, because he had a chance to be photographed with Douglas Fairbanks Sr. When he was a teenager. The still is in the book. It's one of the things I'm proud of. I found the still because he talked about the experience of being on board the ship, the Olympia, where Doug Fairbanks and Mary Pickford were coming back from their honeymoon in Europe. And he was coming over to America with the acrobatic troupe that he joined at the age of 14 after he got himself kicked out of school, which is what he wanted to do anyway, is get kicked out of school. And he said that Fairbanks posed for him with a selfie, basically, you know. And I found the picture.
How did you find it?
It was printed in a movie magazine in 1934.
Wow.
I couldn't find the print itself, but I found the movie magazine that he obviously had given the photo to at some point, and at some point it got lost. But that was the photo, and he just looks like he's about to explode. He's so happy. And Fairbanks is being perfectly nice, but he really responded to Fairbanks' noblesse oblige and his openness to having a picture taken with this English kid on board ship. And Fairbanks has got a deluxe cabin, and, you know, Archie and the rest of the acrobatic troupe are in second class. But, you know, Fairbanks was very democratic. So when they did Gunga Din together, he and Junior, Fairbanks Sr. came to the premiere of Gunga Din. And Grant told Fairbanks Sr. that he had taken a picture with him. This is 20 some years earlier, okay? And 21 years earlier. And Fairbanks didn't remember it, of course, but he was so complimentary about Grant's career and his performance in the movie. And Fairbanks Sr. died shortly thereafter. So Fairbanks Jr. and Grant were very close because of this kind of passing of the torch between the father, Fairbanks Sr., and Fairbanks Jr., and the fact that they worked together in this huge, successful film and stayed friends the rest of their lives, really. But that was an example of the kind of behavior that that Grant himself seldom indulged in. He tended to stay away from public displays, whereas Doug Fairbanks, for instance, was open to posing with a teenage kid from Bristol, and it was fine. And, you know, then he went on his way and he forgot all about it, of course. But fear, Grant was shied away from that kind of thing. He didn't. He would sign autographs. He hated to sign autographs. Late in his life, towards the end of his life, he said that was wrong. He said, I should have been much more relaxed about signing autographs. But he would charge a dollar. He would say, you got a dollar if somebody asked him for an autograph. And that generally ended it, you know. But he, as much as he admired Fairbanks' emotional generosity, he didn't, it was hard for him to display an equivalent generosity. That's a long answer to a short question.
No, that's what I was looking for. So we're talking about the directors that he worked with. I was interested when you wrote about his not getting along too well with Michael Curtiz.
Curtiz hated him.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the body of work of Curtiz, it's amazing. But Curtiz is not an auteur the way these other directors were. What didn't he like about Curtiz?
Curtiz was a screamer. He was a screamer. He yelled. And Grant and all the directors Grant loved, Hawks, McCary, McHitchcock, they're all very cool customers. They all had a very light mood on the set. Hawks never raised his voice at all. McCary liked to play the piano in between shots. And Hitchcock, all the whole movie was in the storyboards that were laying around the set so everybody could see what their next shot was going to be. And everything was put together for Hitchcock because that was the only way he could work. So it was almost a mechanical process with Hitchcock. But the point is that Grant liked a happy set. He didn't want the repetition of his childhood where he had an emotionally compromised mother and an alcoholic father. He didn't want the Sturm und Drang. He didn't want the tension. He had enough of that for the first 14 years of his life. He was never going to put himself in that position again, which is why he refused to work with Billy Wilder. Billy Wilder offered him Sabrina. Billy Wilder offered him Love in the Afternoon. Billy Wilder offered him 1, 2, 3. And I think there was one other one in there someplace. And he turned them all down. It drove Wilder nuts because Sabrina and Love in the Afternoon are tailor-made for Cary Grant, you know. And he simply wouldn't do it. And Wilder was not abusive. And he didn't raise his voice. But he had sharp elbows. He could be very sarcastic. And I just don't. I think Grant was just not going to go there. And Wilder was European. He was Austrian and Curtiz was Hungarian, and that's pretty close.
Well, I love Humphrey Bogart, but I think that Sabrina would have been a lot more believable with.
Oh, well, yeah. Bogart looks like he's at death's door, basically, partially because he's working opposite Audrey Hepburn, who looks like she's 18. Right. What's she doing with her grandfather, for God's sake? I mean, and she goes off with if you're going to cast Humphrey Bogart, you should have rewritten the ending so she goes off with William Holden. Even though he looks terrible in blonde hair, but it just would have made it more sense. As it is, it seems willfully perverse,
creepy.
Yeah, creepy. It's like, well, you better hurry up. That's not May September. That's May late December.
It's interesting how that's a movie. Sabrina's a movie that modern audiences find much creepier than contemporary.
Well, it's because of the age thing. Yeah. In the '50s. Audrey Hepburn specialized had a specialty in starring with leading men who were looking really bad. Gary Cooper in Love in the Afternoon. Now, Gary Cooper is actually 3 years older than Cary Grant, but Cary Grant looked 15 years younger than Gary Cooper. So nobody would have complained if it had been Gary Cooper in Love or Cary Grant in Love in the Afternoon. But right. Because it's Gary Cooper who is about the same stage Bogart was,
right.
In Sabrina, it looks weird. And there's just no way around it. And we're more sensitive to that, I think, today. Probably, maybe even overly sensitive to that today. But certainly, those are two examples. And then she'd worked with Fred Astaire and Funny Girl. Not Funny Girl, Funny Face.
Funny Face, right.
And Astaire looks pretty good. Astaire still looks good in that, and he's dancing as well as he ever did. So he kind of gets away with it.
I think he complained bitterly that his co-stars kept getting younger as he got older.
Well, that's showbiz.
And I think that's one of the reasons that Fred Astaire pulled away from movies. And
well, even when he started doing the TV specials, his leading lady was Barry Chase, who was like 24, 26. Yes. And they fell in love. He fell in love with her. I don't think she fell in love with him. He fell in love with her. But his wife had died and he was vulnerable. And he was at that age where you want someone to bring you your tea and hot slippers at night.
Insane. those TV specials are interesting because there's really an extension of of Astaire's career. In an
oh, yeah. Way. And they're very good. So the first two especially, there's some staggeringly good dancing in there. Yeah. He really hadn't lost anything off his fastball. The last special, you can see he's doing a kind of different dancing to compensate, I think, for his diminishing physical resources, because by that time he's 66 years old or 67, however old he was.
Yeah.
And it's like watching, you know, a Pancho Gonzalez play tennis at 70. You have to give up something at some point, you know, when yeah. you're an athlete, and a dancer is an athlete.
Is an athlete for sure. He didn't make it look like he was an athlete, but he absolutely had.
He was an athlete, though.
Yeah. You talk in your book, Cary Grant, A Brilliant Disguise, about Cary Grant doing a lot of radio work. And so we're just talking about Fred Astaire doing television work. Cary Grant didn't decide, oh, well, now that I'm done with movies, I'll do some TV. He never did.
He wouldn't do television. He had numerous lucrative offers to do television. He never even appeared on a talk show. He wouldn't do it. He thought, if you're going to ask people to pay to see you, you shouldn't give it away for free. It was as simple as that. Lou Wasserman, who made him extremely wealthy at Universal, offered to set him up with a Cary Grant Theater, because Dick Powell had made a great deal of money with the Four Star Playhouse. It was Dick Powell and Charles Boyer and I forget who the female was. Loretta Young. It was Loretta Young, I believe. Oh, anyway, yeah. But a lot of movie stars of a certain age had gone into television and been extremely successful. And they would host the show, and every fifth or sixth show they would star in, you know, as a way of personalizing it. Alfred Hitchcock Presents, the same thing with a famous director. And, you know, Hitchcock would direct one or two episodes a year. And they offered Grant a great deal of money, and he simply walked out of the meeting. He didn't even bother to say no. He just got up and left. Hmm. I think he was actually borderline insulted.
Really? But yeah. Yet radio, he didn't have a problem with radio.
No, he didn't have a problem with radio. He didn't have. Well, the money was pretty good in radio for a rehearsal and a performance. You know, you work 4 or 5 hours and you could make 5-10 grand. That's pretty good money. So that's a different thing. Now, he could have made more in television, but it was also a lot more work. And there was something about radio that didn't offend him the way television did. Because especially for movie stars of that generation, you think of television in the 50s and 60s, it's a step down. It's D-class A from the movie business. Now, it's actually superseded the movie business, let's be honest. There's really not a pecking order. If you don't want to do a movie, you can go do something for Netflix or Amazon or Hulu or whatever it is. And then you can go do another movie. You don't demean yourself by doing something for a streaming service. But in the 50s or 60s, it was regarded as a definite step down, that like you were clutching at the ladder on your way down.
Yeah, there were very few actors who crossed over between the two mediums. Absolutely.
And that was also a component of why Grant left, because he wanted to go out on top. And he'd seen a lot of actors hang around too long. And been slowly diminished by circumstance, by age, by changing tastes. And he didn't want that to happen to him. And he was always afraid of that. There's a story in the book that he and George Stevens were talking. I forget which picture it was, whether it was Penny Serenade or Talk. It was Talk of the Town. And they were talking, and they were somehow or another, the subject came up, a Chaplin film called Payday, which has a sequence, it's a two-reeler, has a sequence where Charlie's getting on a streetcar, and more people get on the streetcar, and he's gradually forced off the rear of the streetcar, you know? Grant said, that's the story of Hollywood. That's the story of Hollywood. You know, you get on the streetcar that you struggled to get onto for 20 years, and then new stars come along and they gradually push you off the back of the streetcar, and you're left in the middle of the street wondering what happened. And he never wanted, and he used that, he would tell that story several times, that Hollywood's like a streetcar. And I think he was determined to not be one of those people, cast-offs, where people go, whatever happened to Meg Ryan? Why'd she stop making movies? You know? Right. Well, it's complicated, you know? But there are actors that suddenly disappear, at major, major stars who just one day they're there, and like 3 years later, you realize they haven't done anything, you know?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
He didn't want that to happen. He didn't want anybody saying, whatever happened to Cary Grant?
I can't remember who you said he said got off the back. John Gilbert got off the back.
No, it was Adolph Monju. He said Adolph Monju got pushed off the back, but he keeps running around to the front and getting back on, which is true. If he couldn't be a star, he'd be a character actor. And he was a great character actor till the day he died, you know, but he refused to be pushed off.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro here on KSCO. Continuing today our conversation with film historian Scott Eyman. His new book is called Cary Grant, A Brilliant Disguise.
Talk a little bit about, I mean, one of the things that Cary Grant is famous for is his involvement with LSD. Mm-hmm. What did you discover about that?
Well, his essential problem was trying to assimilate Archie with Cary. That was the core problem. And as he once said, after enlightenment descended on him, courtesy of acid, Cary Grant didn't have any problems. Archie Leach had problems. But he had to figure out how to assimilate Archie with Cary instead of having Archie as a kind of sublimated alter ego, you know. And he tried psychotherapy and he didn't like it. It was too, he felt it was too invasive and it took too bloody long. And it does. You know, there are people who have been in therapy for 40 years. And I just think, give it up. It's not working, you know. And he just thought it was endless. And so and he tried LSD. At the time, it was legal. Or it wasn't illegal, shall we say. He had to be taken under medical supervision, but it wasn't illegal. And for him, it turned the trick. It enabled him to. It reordered his brain chemistry in a way that he found effective. The people that knew him before LSD and after LSD didn't really see much change, but it made him feel better. It made him feel more comfortable with who he was than he had been before. But as far as people who worked with him, he was still the same guy. But internally, it made him better. And he became essentially Captain Trips for the Southern California community. Anybody that was thinking of doing acid would know to go to him and talk to him and see if he were to recommend it for them. And if so, where should they go? Which doctor should they go to, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So he was, and there's a section in the book, Timothy Leary, he had a meeting with Tim Leary in his office at Universal. And, you know, because nobody dropped more acid than Leary. Grant did pretty well. He did well over 100 trips initially supervised. Later on, he felt secure enough so that he would just do it in the house without anybody else around.
For recreation or for,
not according to him. He had a very convenient, funny attitude about drugs. He was very anti-drug. And he explained the difference is people do marijuana or cocaine to escape reality. And LSD intensifies reality. It makes you copacetic with reality. It's not an avoidance of reality, which is, of course, it's convenient. I don't know what he thought after LSD became completely legal, you know, a banned substance. I'm sure it didn't change his high opinion of the drug. It certainly worked for him, or he felt it worked for him, even though he did have some unfortunate trips. But he felt the sum total of the experience was completely positive. It made him a better person.
Did he come to a point where he stopped, or did he continue his whole life with it?
I'm not sure. It my guess is he stopped. Certainly when his daughter was born. I don't think he would risk having tabs around the house with a child. That would just be not a good idea, because he really did hover over her very protectively.
I'm interested in the change in American film acting that occurred in the mid 50s, kind of in the middle of Cary Grant's career, or I guess the latter part of his career. You know, that is when Montgomery Clift and Marlon Brando and those people arrived. And of course, you talk about Clift and John Wayne meeting in Red River. But how did Cary Grant feel about that new style of acting, and did he have to encounter it as an actor?
I think he was threatened by it, as so many people were. He didn't like Brando at all as an actor. I don't know if they ever met, but he didn't like Brando at all. I think he was threatened, as he should have been, because he had tried opening himself up with None But the Lonely Heart, and playing someone a great deal like himself, with conflicts a great deal like Archie Leach's conflicts, predominantly with a mother. And the son can't help the mother and can't satisfy the mother's needs, and vice versa. So they fail each other for 2 hours, and at the end, they fail each other one last time. There's no reconciliation. There's no Jane Darwell sending off, you know, Tom Joad over the mountain. It's just grim. It's a very emotionally grim movie. And it didn't lose much money. I think it lost like $50,000, the figures in the book. So it was not a flop, but it wasn't a success either. And that was really the last time he was willing to play someone who was defeated by life. And if you look at the careers of Brando and Clift, they specialized in people that were defeated by life. Yeah. Really. Because they were seekers of emotional truth. And Grant, if you want to look at it that way, was basically hiding from emotional truth in most of his performances. You know, they were a means of escape for him as an actor. Whereas Clift and Brando went towards the danger. They went towards the danger of failure, of being broken, of being destroyed. And Grant tended to go away from danger. That's why he turned down the films he turned down. He turned down The Star Is Born with George Cukor and Judy Garland. He turned down The Third Man. He turned down The Man Who Would Be King. He turned down a slew of pictures. He turned down Lolita. Well, he never would have done Lolita. That's a non-starter. He's not gonna play Humbert Humbert. But he certainly could have played Norman Maine. He certainly could have played Harry Lime. He certainly could have played either Danny or Peachy in The Man Who Would Be King. But they're all pretty bleak characters, you know? Well, not Danny and Peachy. The end is bleak, but their characters are not bleak. But Harry Lime and Norman Maine are pretty bleak.
Yeah,
and well, he wouldn't get it. And it wasn't a question of the money. The money was there. They were going to give him what he wanted. And he wanted a lot because he needed money. Emotionally, he needed a lot of money. Not practically. He was quite well off quite quickly. But psychologically, he wanted more and more money as insulation. If he made even two of those pictures, his career would be a much different career than it was. And we wouldn't just be talking about The Glories of Bringing Up Baby and His Girl Friday and To Catch a Thief and Notorious. We'd be talking about him as not just as the best light comedian of the 20th century. We'd be talking about him as a great dramatic actor as well. But he wouldn't go there.
Who would have been his partner had he made The Man Who Would Be King, which was eventually shot?
Well, Bogart was dead and Gable hadn't died yet. So I think this is 1960. This is like 6 months before Gable died. So Houston's trying to set it up with Gable and Cary Grant. And that would have worked wonderfully, you know, because Gable is much more rough hewn. It's kind of an elderly version of The Man Who Would Be King.
Yeah.
they're both 60-ish as opposed to, I guess, 45 in the Michael Caine, Sean Connery, with whom Houston eventually made the picture. But it still would have worked. You know, but then a couple months after Houston offered Grant the part, Clark Gable died, and that threw it back into, you know, limbo.
Development, yeah. Talk a little bit about Hitchcock. So you were saying that Hitchcock worked very closely with Jimmy Stewart, and that Jimmy Stewart contributed story ideas and helped shape Jimmy Stewart Hitchcock films. Who made more? I think they made about the same amount of pictures that was Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart.
Rope, Rear Window, Man Who Knew Too Much, Vertigo. So that's four.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Grant made four too. But the difference is that Grant was not a creative partner. Stewart was a partner on Rear Window, a partner on The Man Who Knew Too Much, and a partner in Vertigo, financial partner. And I suspect partially a creative partner as well. Grant was a salaried employee. There's a difference. He didn't, and I don't think Hitchcock thought of Grant in that kind of creative way. He loved Grant. Grant was his favorite leading man, as always. He offered Grant Torn Curtain. Well, it's good that didn't happen.
Yeah.
But he offered Grant a lot of parts that Grant didn't take for one reason or another. But Grant was his ideal leading man, Absolutely. In the same way, John Wayne was John Ford's ideal leading man. Everybody else was second best.
I recently read your Louis B. Mayer book, which you wrote quite a few years ago, I had missed it until recently. And I found it to be so great because not only was it about Louis B. Mayer, but I mean, inescapably, it is about the whole arc of the history of Hollywood that you...
Yeah, that's why I wrote about it. I wanted to... It's my studio system book, basically, through the prism of this one guy.
And, you know, today, we just kind of touched on this a little while ago. Modern audiences are constantly reexamining classic Hollywood films through our, you know, enlightened prism of knowledge that we're so enlightened now. What do you think when you hear that Gone with the Wind is banned from, you know, what, just for example, what is your take on all that?
Well, I've lived a long time, so you know the cultural cross currents get whipped up. I live on the coast of Florida, so you get these siroccos that you know blow in, and suddenly it's torrential downpours, and you know 20 minutes later the sun's shining, and the American culture has gotten a little bit like that. So it's not unlike living in Florida during hurricane season. Where'd that come from? Where'd that go? You know. The thing about Gone with the Wind, what all the criticism of Gone with the Wind, some of which is perfectly justified. On the other hand, Selznick's only is making a romantic melodrama. You know, he's not trying to make a cultural, racially sensitive document. It's a romantic melodrama. That said, Mammy is the emotional core of the movie. She's the one who understands Scarlett for what she is, and she understands Rhett Butler for what he is. And she knows the truth. She's the emotional and truth-telling core of that film. And to basically negate the entire picture ignores that. And it also ignores what I think is a superb performance by Hattie McDaniel. So is she playing a domestic? Yes. But that's not all she's playing by any stretch of the imagination.
And she got her Oscar for it.
And she got an Oscar for it. And she deserved an Oscar for it. That doesn't happen all that often.
I was thinking of a picture that you know well, which is called The Return of Frank James with Henry Fonda that was directed by Fritz Lang.
Yeah.
And there's a character in there that's purely the comic relief in the picture of Henry Fonda's slave, I guess, essentially. I guess because people don't see that picture with the same regularity as they see Gone with the Wind, which is too bad because it's a great picture. But you know, that's probably a much more racist kind of portrayal of a character. And that's the kind of thing you see in Hollywood films all the time.
Sure.
Do those kind of portrayals mar those movies? Should film students not see them?
No, I think they need to see them. I think they need to see where we were in order to gauge where we are. I think the more films you see, the more accurate appraisal you can make about the culture you grew up in. Or the culture your parents or grandparents grew up in, which affects the culture you grow up in.
Well, of course, one of the great things about reading your book, Cary Grant, A Brilliant Disguise, is going back and watching all those Cary Grant movies. It puts you right in the mood. You go to...
Oh, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. Because I like a lot of Cary Grant movies.
There are some really great ones.
His batting average was very good. Very good. Even at the very tail end, Charade is a nice picture. I don't think it's great, but it's a Hitchcock imitation, but it's a good Hitchcock imitation. I like Indiscreet a great deal. I think Father Goose, it's a sitcom, but he's having a great time. He's obviously liberated by playing a grumpy old man who doesn't shave and pads around in dungarees, which is exactly what he was, as a matter of fact. He was a little on the grumpy side. He didn't dress up unless he had to dress up. He dressed down. He liked to wear a caftan, for God's sake. You know, I mean, just pop it over your head and you're done. He didn't focus on being Cary Grant unless he had to be Cary Grant. But he's having a fine time. The last picture's terrible, but you know, not everybody lucks out with their last picture. Sometimes you're John Wayne and you luck out with something like The Shootist. Other times you're Gary Cooper and you're stuck with A Naked Edge or, you know, Walk Don't Run for Cary Grant. It's not worthy of you, but you know, he walked away.
One of the hardest things I think to do in a biography is to bring that person to life on the page, and you've absolutely done it again with Cary Grant, A Brilliant Disguise. And Scott Eyman, thank you so much for talking with us about it on From the Bookshelf.
Happy to do it, Gary, anytime.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.